Wednesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. We are assured at least one more game in the 2015-16 NBA season after the Cavs destroy the Warriors 120-90. Danny is on site and it's already midnight Eastern, so we're going to give him the night off. And in his stead, frequent and welcome Dunked On Podcast guest and new Burmese food aficionado, Kevin Pelton.
Yeah, I owe you an appearance for that dinner the other night, which was fabulous.
So basically, it's kind of funny, right? Like, I predicted that the Warriors would win in six, and I said that the Cavs would get really hot in a couple of the games, and that would be how they would win their two games, but they couldn't stop the Warriors. The part about not being able to stop the Warriors was wrong. They scored, but they also got really hot tonight. And maybe this is another feather in the cap for the theory that after two games, you shouldn't just totally discount what you think of your pre-series expectations.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very interesting example in the question of how much do we overreact to the most recent event, you know, the recency bias. Because obviously after game two, all of us were ready to declare this series over, that maybe Cleveland could get one more. But, you know, there was fans saying to each other or to the ushers, you know, see you next year at the end of game two, because they were assuming that they were not going to be back for game five, which they will. And I will be back in the Bay Area for that. So, you're right that if you had just told us that the series was going to go 2-1 at this point and that the Cavs were going to shoot, 12 of 25 from three-point range in their win, and that Golden State was going to shoot poorly from three-point range in their loss, I think that would have made sense to a lot of us. What I don't think would have made sense that you went from 33-point win to 30-point loss.
Yeah, that may be the case. And also, I think the fact that maybe Kevin Love being out, the Cavaliers look a little bit better, certainly defensively from an intensity standpoint. That's just not necessarily what Kevin Love brings. And so that's going to be something to monitor. You obviously missed the game with the concussion. I think the biggest thing for here for the Cavs was, all right, you know, we know that Kyrie was going to get hot. He's really one of the best mid-range kind of bad shot makers that we have in the league. LeBron hitting his jumper might have been somewhat unexpected. He was 4 out of 8 outside the paint during the competitive portion of the game. But how did they stop the Warriors? And do you think that that is more the Warriors having a bad game, or has Cleveland actually found something here?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few things at play here, because I think, yeah, you would have expected, like, their offensive numbers were so bad in the first two games of this series that they couldn't possibly continue that way. And we probably should have lent more credence to that fact when considering how this series was going to go going forward. But I think the other aspect of it is, you know, at least I kind of felt like, well, Steph, you know, played very well in game two, but was limited by foul trouble, played poorly in game one. Klay Thompson hadn't gone off in this series. So Cleveland might be closer, you know, might be better offensively back home, but Golden State also was likely to be better offensively because of how badly they've played. And that's really, I think, where this diverged from our expectations. So I think a lot of it, you know, it started with one of the suggestions I had in my column after game two is that they should stop switching off ball screens because that had been such a problem for them. And Ty Lue's answer in pregame, I think you noted on Twitter, seemed to indicate that it wasn't about a change in game plan. It was about just executing what they were doing. And that's what you saw, I thought, with both their intensity level and their focus in terms of not making the kind of mental mistakes that plagued them in games one and two of this series. And that was a huge difference. I mean, I thought that it might tail off after the first quarter and that they were just kind of feeding off the home crowd, but they were able to maintain it all game long and really did a terrific job defending Steph and everyone else off the ball, I thought.
Yeah, part of that was they just didn't screw up the communication nearly as often, although they still did, but then they were forcing the Warriors further out on the floor to execute their offense. It's just harder to make those backdoor passes when there's more pressure on the ball when you're further out. And also they weren't really in any situations, because they were scoring so well, where the Warriors were able to get out in transition or semi-transition situations where they are causing trouble. And the Warriors also, I thought, played extremely poorly. They had some really bad turnovers, and you know, it wasn't even that Cleveland was getting so many steals. They only had 7 steals, but there are 17 Warriors turnovers in the competitive portion of the game, really around a 20% rate all game. And a lot of those were just unforced plays, throwing it out of bounds, kind of kicking it out of bounds. So it was. I think it was really a combination of all those factors, but there's no denying that the Cavs just played much, much better defensively. And I think not having a weak link like Love that the Warriors could just attack when it got late in the shot clock really helped a lot.
It does, but at the same time, if the other four guys on the court played with the same kind of effort that they did tonight with Love on the court, I don't think that, you know, it's a question the Warriors would have a plan B to go to in terms of going to, you know, Steph Curry pick and rolls, but they never really went to that tonight. It seemed like that was not a focus of their offense. They were really trying to use him off the ball. So maybe they would have done that differently, but it's not like they did that in games one and two. They never needed to get to plan B in games one and two.
That said, the Warriors with Andrew Bogut, who played the first 6 minutes of each half, essentially, when the Warriors were negative 21, that really accounted for the entire margin of this game. And obviously, Curry was bad. I thought Thompson actually low-key was even worse than he was. He was just taking some awful, awful shots, even, you know, worse than some of the ones that he was hitting in Game 6 against Oklahoma City. He just didn't have his feet set. But, you know, the Cavs went to a small lineup. I understand why Steve Kerr didn't want to change up his starters for either half and go with the death lineup to start, because they're winning in this series, and I think he just doesn't like the mental message that that sends to his team about, like, hey, we're adjusting to them, even though what we're doing is theoretically working, but maybe now it's time for a change.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have the same kind of margin for error. I would have looked at this as a great opportunity to effectively finish off the series. If you go up 3-0, no one has come back from that, obviously, in NBA history. That, to me, would have been a chance to have that killer instinct. And I don't think we saw that from Steve Kerr, and I don't think we saw that from the team either, reflected in, you know, their defense was not at the same level of intensity and effort as Cleveland was displaying at the other end, and then the turnovers you mentioned. But, yeah, Kerr, in terms of what he can control. You know, I thought when he went to Andre Iguodala to start game seven and played Klay Thompson at the start of the second quarter, made those changes, that was the indication that, okay, from this point forward, we're going to play optimally. As much as I believe in keeping everyone involved and, you know, sending good messages to players that if they work hard and, you know, if they've been a part of what we're doing all season, we're not going to cut them out. It seemed like that was the point at which, okay, we've passed the point where now every game is critical. Every game is a game that we need to win. And that wasn't the case tonight.
Yeah, I think Kerr also just has a little bit more old school stubbornness than people give him, I don't want to say credit for, but maybe understand, because they play this beautiful new school offense and they move the ball. And I like all of that. Obviously, he's a great coach. I think he's a top two coach in the league overall. But I feel like he almost doesn't want to reward his players and bail them out by going the easy way out. He wants them to win, you know, the conventional style, get guys like Bogut to just play better. But I think especially to start the second half, it just, with how badly they got worked, the chance that they could have gotten right back in, we're only down eight, and just letting them get outscored, I think it was 7-0 to start that quarter with Bogut in. And I mean, you could say, all right, Curry's got to play better, blah, blah, blah. But part of the reason he doesn't is because Bogut is a relative non-threat, and they just do better with the floor space. And then also the other problem is you don't have Andre Iguodala guarding LeBron James. And then when you bring him in, even if you bring him in early, you have to take him out again because he just can't play all those minutes consecutively. So I think he should be starting the death lineup in game four, especially he has the excuse to do it because Cleveland is starting LeBron at the four now. You know, it's not like the other team is going conventionally and you're like, all right, we're going to steal some minutes for Bogut here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best defense of it is that it's hard to play Bogut with the second unit because, as you've talked about many times on the podcast in the past, he needs to be out there with guys who are good shooters and passers to take advantage of his own passing skills. So you kind of have to go all or nothing with Bogut. You either start him.
Yeah, he's so bad on the road, I just would be fine not playing him. Like, he hasn't had a good game on the road in like 3 months.
That's reasonable. Also, let's talk about Anderson Varejao. Can we talk about Anderson Varejao?
Well, I mean, it would be a first for the Dunktown podcast, but go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That was, I mean, I guess he's trying for a spark because you're already so far behind at that point. But come on, just play Festus Ezeli. Anderson Varejao is the fifth best center on this team. It is insane to have him playing key minutes in a competitive NBA Finals game. That is, it's unacceptable.
It was insane when he played in the third quarter of Game 7, and they broke it open. I knew that that was going to subject us now to, you know, games and games more of Varejao. I think he's probably going to come back for the minimum next year, too, I bet you. But it's, yeah, I think the fact that the coaching staff has not trusted Azeli at all in these playoffs has been something, a bone that I had to pick with them, because he's their only big who can actually switch in the late clock, deal with them in pick and roll, and both LeBron James and Kyrie Irving really hurt them in 1-5 pick and rolls in this game, whether it was Varejao, whether it was Bogut, especially in that third quarter. And the other thing, too, is that the Warriors' defense really just made some awful, uncharacteristic mistakes. There was Steph Curry losing J.R. Smith just on the strong side, taking his eye off him, assuming that he's cutting through, and J.R. just went back to the corner and hit a wide-open three. Steph also let Kyrie get some back doors in the first quarter. Steph had some terrible reaches. I mean, that was part of the problem. He couldn't get into rhythm until the second half because he was in foul trouble, and just two of them, again, one was grabbing Kyrie's jersey, the other one was just a dumb reach when he'd already gone by him, so he was only himself to blame on that. But I did think that the Cavaliers, in addition to the fact that Irving and had more confidence shooting, I think that was something that was bound to happen, but the lineup at the start of the fourth with Fry at center, unless the Warriors have all five guys in the death lineup, or maybe Sean Livingston in for one of them, they're going to really struggle to guard that lineup, I think. And with James hitting his jumper, all of a sudden that looked really unstoppable.
It did. And one of the reasons why I've wanted Fry to play more in this series, he also, as you mentioned on Twitter, showed that he could keep up defensively as long as there was a little bit of a hiding spot for him.
Yeah. In fairness to Ty Lue, for the first time in the series, though, he'd been bad.
He had. And even in the second quarter, when they went to that lineup that has been good, so good for them in the playoffs, the Warriors comfortably outplayed that with Draymond at center and started their run there. So, maybe who knows whether he's really turned the corner, but that was certainly the most eventful thing that happened in the last 20 minutes of this game, was seeing that lineup succeed, I think.
So I don't make a ton of this game for the rest of the series. Like, how do you feel about it? Has your conception of the series changed at all as a result of this game?
I think it's moved back towards what it was at the start of this series, where I still think the Warriors are heavy favorites, but that, we could be potentially looking at a 6 or even 7-game series as opposed to a sweep or a gentleman sweep being the overwhelmingly likely outcomes.
To me, there are a couple of things that could maybe have changed things. Obviously, the Warriors were terrible on both ends. Like, let's not lose sight of that. They're going to play better in this series, even if it's in only their home games. But two things happened. One was just the defense being better without Love. And I know we don't want to make too much of a whipping boy of Love. He wasn't that bad. But he also just, maybe just the overall energy and intensity is higher. But then the other thing that I thought was huge was LeBron James actually hitting his jump shot. Now, I'm not going to trust that over the larger sample size of since the beginning of the 2015 playoffs. But if he could just stay hot on his jump shot, that changes everything about the way that the Warriors are defending him.
I mean, I think, it's not even necessarily him making those shots. It's him just having the confidence to take them, I think, first off, is a big potential change in how the Warriors defend him.
Yeah, I think that's right, too. If he hits 35%, like, that's enough as a defender to get in your head and say, all right, I can't just let this guy shoot this wide open. And, we saw for the first time in the series, really, James blew by Andre Iguodala in the half court along the baseline, and he didn't score on the play, through the pass to the corner, but Andre had to be up on him. He blew by Draymond Green, especially in those minutes when Fry was on the floor in the corner. Harrison Barnes is not like an intelligent enough help defender to kind of help and guard Fry, and so I think the Warriors having to get more up on James, that could make it where, all right, now your strategy of taking away the three-point line didn't work that well. And then also, I think they're able to get J.R. Smith some open shots. Again, I think a lot of those due to bad Warriors defense, but also just because Smith was more aggressive.
Yeah, and you noticed that early on in the game, they set an off-ball screen. I think it was Tristan Thompson screened for Smith, trying to set him up for a catch-and-shoot three, which indicates to me that it was something they were really thinking about, wanting to get him more involved after he was largely invisible in the first two games.
Yeah, whenever Golden State has a center on the floor, especially with LeBron at the four, Cleveland needs to and has been doing a great job of going right at that center, having Thompson set the screen, or Fry if the center is guarding Fry, which he usually isn't. And I think they can really get guys open. And finally, this is a very, very talented offensive team, and just being able to get those shots, I think everyone just felt a little bit better about letting those shots fly at home, and they hit a few early, and then the confidence proved infectious.
Yeah, and they still didn't take that many threes. They only took 25 of them, which is relatively on the low side compared to what they were doing in the playoffs. But when you make those at a 48% clip, you're going to make them count.
Yeah, and the bigger thing, too, is that a lot of those are wide open. They're not off the dribble, tough shots, like LeBron taking five threes, you know, basically all of them off the dribble. Kyrie, all of his shots were off the dribble those first two games. Now it's spot-up looks for guys like Smith, even Shumpert, Richard Jefferson. Like, those are just the quality of those looks to me was much better. And then guys like Thompson, you know, he was just taking such bad shots as well. You know, that 2 of 14 that the Warriors shot on threes in the first half, I thought they kind of earned that, frankly. I mean, they missed a couple of open ones, but Thompson's really were all bad looks except for one that he had in transition.
It reminded me of the first couple of games of the Oklahoma City series where it seemed like Thompson was really rushing shots because of the fact that there weren't the open looks available for him.
What do you make of the fact that Steph Curry hasn't, and I don't want to say he didn't have a good game because he had a good game in game two, but obviously the foul trouble was involved. Do you make anything now of his relative struggle, certainly to where he was at the end of the Oklahoma City series? We kind of thought he was back. And then obviously compared to the regular season.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this was a weird one in terms of he just seemed disengaged, really. And, you know, Steve Kerr taking him out briefly in the second quarter, you know, he did have two fouls at that point, I think. But just kind of getting him over there to ask him, are you okay, was a really odd moment. Can you remember a situation like that where Curry got taken out for reasons that, you know, didn't have anything to do with the usual rotation or foul trouble?
Yeah, that's happened on occasion, I think, when Steph is just kind of, it'll take him out maybe a little bit earlier when he's just sort of like in like weirdo turnover mode, the way he kind of will get sometimes. And I think Steph seems like a larger variance superstar in some ways because he is just so reliant on these kind of superhuman plays in some ways that then when he tries those and they don't work, it can look a lot worse than if, you know, it's just LeBron James going for an ISO and just missing the shot, you know. So that I think there is something to that, to where maybe we overreact to his struggles more than some people's. But nonetheless, I think they do need to get him the ball more in pick and roll. I mean, I saw actually that a stat that the Warriors actually set less on-ball screens than all but one team, which is very surprising because we talked so much about Steph in the pick and roll. And obviously part of that's too that Livingston doesn't do any pick and rolls hardly at all. So I think getting him in the middle of the floor and then on those ISOs, getting him away from the sideline. I thought the Cavaliers strategy really worked well. It seemed like they were trying to just make him pick a side when they got switched off and then send him into the help. I thought that worked great.
Yeah, it's almost like this is after the screen, but it's almost like downing the screen where you use the sideline as a help defender, and they were doing that kind of afterwards. By the way, to go back to the point, seeing the Steve Kerr post-game press conference transcript come across my email, Kerr's explanation for why he took him out was, I wanted to tell him something that I saw, so I took him out, talked to him for a second, and put him back in.
Ah, okay. That's, and I'm sure Steve told everyone in a subsequent answer exactly what that was. He actually will not be that revealing, which of course is right. I would do the same in his situation. Some little things that I wanted to talk about. I thought that Irving was just better in general. You know, when there are some times where they set some double screens, sending Curry all the way across the court, and he was able to just get through them without help at all. That was good. And Cleveland fans, you're booing Anderson Varejao, seriously, like louder than any other Warrior? He didn't ask to be traded. I guess he maybe asked for that contract extension, but it's not his fault that they gave it to him.
Yeah, yeah. Can't blame him there.
What do you see in terms of adjustments for both teams now?
Well, I mean, we talked about, you know, the lineup, I think, is probably the biggest thing from the Warriors. I'm not sure I see a ton else that they do differently besides that and more pick and roll. With Cleveland, obviously, the most important and most interesting question is what happens with Love, you know, coming back and how you handle that if he's available for game four.
Yeah, for me, I think we talked about starting the death lineup already. I think if Love comes back, he's got to come off the bench, maybe just under the guise of, hey, you're coming back from a concussion. You haven't really been able to condition yourself these last couple of games. I do think if Love plays, he should play largely at center. And just try to outscore the Warriors. That's what I thought. I always thought that or Fry at center was their best chance in this series because then they could at least keep up with the Warriors offensively. More of Fry at center, obviously, as well. And I think keep running stuff for JR. I really liked their plan, but really, of course, it was more execution helped by the crowd. No Varejão for Golden State. I think we can both agree on that. I would probably just dump Bogut too. I'd just go back to basically your same rotation from game four on in the finals last year. More Azili, because I think when they have the ability to switch, they can force the Cavs into, you know, playing iso ball, and sometimes they'll get hot, like Kyrie did a lot today. But you don't give a weak link to attack. And when Bogut is in, when Varejão is in, there is that weak link. I think Azili at least can get out high on the pick and roll and even switch himself reasonably well.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one thing Ty Lue needs to be prepared for is the possibility that things just don't work as well as they did in this game. And that's where, you know, even though you're probably not going into game four with a lot of plans to adjust things, or, you know, like you said, you probably start out thinking about using Love off the bench and kind of, you know, hiding him a little bit defensively that way. But if the lineup with Richard Jefferson isn't nearly as effective, especially if the Warriors are going more to the death lineup, then I think you have to be prepared to sort of adjust and counter that.
Yeah, and also for the Warriors, maybe Steph Curry could just stop doing dumb reach-ins. Like, that would be a nice adjustment for them, too. And also something to monitor is that Klay had that contusion. That's the sort of thing that can kind of swell up and be more of an issue in the next couple of days. So we'll have to keep an eye on those reports. So we're going to do a little mini mailbag, which has been long overdue on the show. KP and I will pick out some questions. But first, I want to tell you about our new friends at Athletes Collective. KP listens to the podcast when he's running. Hopefully, he might consider Athletes Collective as an option, because being a practical person, maybe he doesn't believe in logos quite as much. And while we may admire these great pro athletes, wearing the same logos that they do doesn't make you any better at sports and doesn't even necessarily signify any better quality. Athletes Collective has no logos. It's great quality, great fitting activewear without the logos for 30 to 40% cheaper than some of those big brands. And you can go to athletescollective.com, get started with them by using that familiar cap space code, and that lets them know that you came from us, and gets them to keep advertising, and also gets you 15% off your first order, which includes free shipping and returns to the U.S. of Canada. The founder, Adam, is a listener of the show, really enjoys it. That's part of why he wanted to advertise. So he's a part of the Dunked On community, and hopefully you will become part of the Athletes Collective community as well, with this awesome pre-shrunk stuff that you can wash very easily. Don't have to worry about it shrinking like some of the other brands. So athletescollective.com, cap space code is the promo code, 100% satisfaction guaranteed. All right, so any of these questions pop out to you here, you want to try?
Well, I guess let's start with the first comment on here, Michael Casper, who asks about the, based on sport view or eye test, if not available, did the Warriors still get okay shots and just miss, much like game three or four of the Thunder series, or did the Cavs D cause those misses? I mean, I think, first off, player tracking data that I've been referencing and several other people have been referencing on ESPN during the playoffs, not available until the next day, so we won't know the actual shot quality of the Warriors. But I think one thing that stood out to me was the number of times that they were playing deep into the shot clock and getting bad shots because of that. You know, I remember Harrison Barnes three off the dribble, Klay Thompson forcing up a shot from the mid post with the shot clock running out. And there were a few of those, which I think were a different for them than game one and two. What do you think?
Well, we saw that the Cavs were giving up like 10, 12, 14 points a game just on easy backdoor layups.
Right.
And other than for moments in the second quarter, those were not available for the Warriors. So I would say that's the number one thing. And then their three-pointers. You know, I mentioned how Klay's feet just weren't set. He was coming off the screens, really kind of frustrated, just firing it up without his right foot behind his left, like just on the move, not really getting a chance to square up. And so, yeah, I think that those shots were much harder. Same thing for Steph. He didn't really get any wide open ones, especially in that first half. So, no, I think the Cavs D caused the misses much more so, although part of it might have been bad Warriors shooting. By the end of the game, it really wasn't that bad.
Yeah, and Curry made up a little bit of that difference in the third quarter. It just didn't matter much on the scoreboard.
So Danny just texted me the hustle stats. The Cavaliers had 21 deflections to the Warriors 9. Yeah, that'll make a pretty big difference.
Yeah, that seems to reflect what we saw on the court in this game.
And the other thing that was huge too is screen assists. The Cavaliers had 12 and the Warriors only had 3. So that showed that the Cavaliers switching was effective, Whereas the Warriors, the Cavaliers were able to really attack their centers because that's the plays that they're not switching generally. And that's how they're able to get a lot of screen assists. And then, of course, that guys like Kyrie and LeBron actually hit the resulting shots afterwards, and so did JR.
Yeah, hard to get a screen assist without making the shot.
All right, let me find one here. Jacob Belgum, why is Curry playing with no force slash effort slash confidence offensively? You know, part of it I think is the foul trouble stopping him from getting in rhythm. I thought that he was fine in game two. You know, he just didn't play that many minutes. He had 18 points in 23 minutes and was extremely efficient. So, you know, I think part of it was that he just couldn't get in rhythm. Part of it is that the Cavaliers' intensity was better. And part of it is just not putting the ball in his hands enough, just too much of the kind of off-the-ball stuff. And that stuff works great when the other team's defense is doing a bad job of switching and communicating. But now that the Cavs seem to have cleaned that up a little bit, and also just not having Love as a guy that they can go at off the ball, you know, I think just they got to put the ball in his hands more in pick and roll, get some of those tasty four on threes. We didn't see hardly any of those 4-on-3s in this game.
No, I mean, I can't think of any of them. I think another factor there maybe is it seems like teams are getting away with being more physical with him defending off the ball, and that's making it difficult. You know, Cleveland wasn't able to do that because they weren't close enough to hold him in games 1 and 2, but they were in game 3.
All right, you got one?
Maybe let's go with Sam Lawrence. Is this game the best evidence yet that LeBron's future at the four, and perhaps it ought to be his present as well? I mean, it's tough to say because, you know, he was playing an even smaller position. He was playing 5 in game 2, and while it got him a couple of dunks or layups that were uncontested, he didn't really play that well overall in that role. So I do think his best position is power forward at this point in his career. I think actually probably always was. We just didn't know it back then. But I don't know that this game is necessarily the best evidence for it.
Well, I think probably what Sam is noting is that he played much better offensively. Well, it's not like they have a non-shooter at the four normally. Kevin Love is probably a more threatening shooter than Richard Jefferson is. Maybe you can say that Love spends a little more time on the block, but largely he's out on the perimeter and teams respect his three-point shot. So offensively, I don't think it really changes all that much, and Love is probably a more threatening partner in the pick and roll and pick and pop than Jefferson is. I think it's more a question of his defense is much better now at the four, the ability to switch seamlessly, that you don't have nearly as many switches that you're afraid to make. So yeah, I think their defense is clearly much better, especially in this series, because the other thing they did that we didn't talk about was they put LeBron on Draymond Green much more, and so now, you know, it wasn't Tristan Thompson switching that pick and roll, it was LeBron, and although LeBron has declined a little bit, guys are still a little bit scared of like his force and athleticism guarding them, and he just has an effect stepping out on those switches and just even in normal pick and roll defense that even someone like Thompson doesn't necessarily have. So I think it's much more of a defensive thing than it is an offensive thing, when because they're playing with a shooter at the four anyway on offense.
Yeah, good points there.
All right, this is from George Ifiacho. Sorry if I didn't pronounce that correctly, George. But this is we gave our opinion on what they should do with Kevin Love. But his question is, do you think that Kevin Love will start when he comes back?
I don't think so. I mean, I think you're not going to want to mess with the success that you had in this game. And as you mentioned in explaining why you think they shouldn't, the fact that he is coming back from this and his condition isn't there gives you a convenient pretext to not start him.
Agree 100%. And if they, I would be very surprised if they do it, and they probably shouldn't. Simon Martin, this will be the last one. Actually, no, it's your turn, so you can have the last honors if there's one you like.
I was going to go with John Bustani. Why isn't Curry even tempting to take the Cavs bigs off the dribble when he's isolated against them one-on-one on the perimeter? He seems to pass swing the ball every time this happens. And really, I can't think of many times that it happened in this game because, as we talked about, they weren't running very much pick and roll with him. The only time I remember was, I think this was in the second quarter, he went, did a little bit of a dribble move on Thompson and took a step back three that he didn't probably quite create quite as much separation as you're used to him creating on that, but then missed it short off the front rim. Can you think of many other
situations? There's the one in the corner in the third quarter where he just ran right into Klay Thompson, right, who was standing right next to him. I mean, that was the prime example that I used for, hey, you got to get to the middle of the floor once you have this matchup. But then they also started trapping more, especially when Fry was on the floor. We saw that when he came back in Kerr's kind of last-ditch effort in the fourth quarter. All right, you ready to do a little segment on next year's Western Conference Finals participant, the Minnesota Timberwolves?
Oh, wow. We are going bold here.
I forgot. Yeah, this isn't Danny on the other line anymore. He would be totally in agreement with that, probably, since he loves the Wolves.
Can we go like 2019, maybe?
Yeah, that's probably better. So, you know, there are always kind of interesting questions with these. We're in the midst of doing all 30 teams, so if you haven't listened to the previous ones yet, give it a shot. Go back and listen. There's a page that's pinned to the top of my Twitter account that has the link to all of them. What would your just general plan be for this team this year, this summer, next summer, to kind of get them into contention, given the fact that you have some pretty young pieces still in Wiggins and Towns that you're theoretically building around?
Yeah, I think my goal for next season would be to make the playoffs, and I think they can do that without any kind of really dramatic moves this summer. I mean, the West is going to probably be a lot more competitive next season. You can look at a lot of the teams that were in the lottery this year, like Minnesota, and expect them to be better next year. But, you know, I think when you look at just the upgrade that Tom Thibodeau should be defensively, I think that alone, along with the development of their young players, puts them, you know, makes 40 to 45 wins a reasonable target for next season. And I wouldn't be in too much of a hurry to try to get to 50 next year, because I'd be more concerned with, like I said, the 2019 conference finals.
Yeah, even if they just bring these guys back pretty much, you'd have to imagine that they're unlikely to be worse than middle of the pack defensively. And then they already were middle of the pack offensively this year. So it's hard to see them taking a step back in that regard with all these guys that are developing, with Towns coming into his own more. So, yeah, I mean, you know, if you just had to ballpark it, you'd say that even right now, without any acquisitions, they have a decent chance of winning, you know, at least 35 games, if not, you know, high 30s, even into the low 40s. But so you said without doing anything drastic. So what would your plan be? Maybe I'll ask it another way. They've got basically $27 million in space this year. That goes up to about maybe $41 million without their rookies, and maybe a little bit more, like $30 next year, and could be even into the 40s if they were to stretch Petkovic next year. So what sort of player would they have to sign this year where you'd say, all right, we're going to punt on a lot of that space for next year by signing someone to a real long-term contract?
I think it has to be someone who's young enough that you can realistically expect that he's going to be part of this core, you know, for the next 3 or 4 years, not just for the next 1 or 2 years, a veteran who is just going to help you in the here and now. Otherwise, to me, you know, one of the big things is we've seen the last couple of years how much free agents really value the opportunity to win, but I don't think they get as excited about potential as we do. They want to see teams actually win. So I think Minnesota's cap space could be a lot more valuable next summer if they are, in fact, coming off a playoff appearance than it is right now.
Yeah, and Karl Towns maybe gets his first All-Star berth. You're definitely, Tibbs is a really respected coach, but they could kind of see what would happen with him. So, yeah, I think just for accounting purposes, where they're at, if they keep Nikola Petkovic, who is due, he's basically looking like a sunk cost at this point. He is due $12 million this year and $11.6 million next year. They would have $27 million to spend. If they were to stretch him, then that would be $4.7 million a year, basically for 5 years going forward. I would say, unless you just have someone who would be amazing that you could bring in with that extra $5 million or so this year, that's going to make the difference. I would just keep him this year and maybe look to stretch him next year when his hit is only, you know, about a little over $3 million for 3 years. But if they do stretch him, they would be up to 33.8 in space, and they don't really have any major free agents that they need to re-sign with cap holds. So with that space, what do you think they could really use to improve the most this year?
I think the obvious thing is someone at power forward, maybe ideally a combo forward. I do think Nemanja Bjelica showed a little bit in the second half of the season, and you do see European guys often get better in year two, so I wouldn't want to completely try to play him out of the rotation, but he's also not the kind of defender I think that you want at that spot in Tom Thibodeau's system. So someone who's a more athletic player and someone who could allow them to go small in the way that, you know, they did against the Warriors in that big upset that they pulled in Golden State. They used Shabazz Muhammad as their four against the Death lineup. He's definitely not the kind of defender you want with Thibs. So someone is kind of,
although Thibs could maybe help him improve. So that there's that, he's got that going for him. But because I think his tools are actually okay, but he certainly has never shown much defensive aptitude in his career. So I agree with you there.
Or proclivity for defense, I would say. He has strength. That's, I think, is probably his best defense.
He's got length too. He's got pretty long. Yeah, like 7 foot wingspan or something like that.
But that anyway, that's the kind of guy I would be looking first and foremost at.
So I guess there's kind of two types of those guys. There are restricted free agents that maybe they could look to overpay. Or there are guys that are, but overpay for a while that you could grow with this core. And I would put maybe Harrison Barnes, Mo Harkless in that. And then also then maybe they could go with an older guy who you might ideally overpay for 1 year, possibly two, you know, who's like a 30-year-old guy, a Luol Deng, a Marvin Williams, that kind of guy. Maybe lower in the market, a Jared Dudley, Lance Thomas sort, but those would be the guys I would be looking at. Is there anyone that you think would be a better or worse fit out of those guys or anyone else that you like for them that I didn't name?
To me, the single best fit for them, even though I don't love this guy, you like him a lot more than I do, is Solomon Hill.
Yeah, because Solomon can kind of guard 1 through 4, maybe even 5 in a pinch if it's not too much of a threatening guy. I mean, your question is just, is his three-point shooting that he showed down the very end of the year and in that series against the Raptors real? I like his form. He also has shot very poorly over a pretty large sample. So I'm guessing what you think the answer to that is about whether he'll be able to maintain that or not. But yeah, I think he'd be great for them defensively. I do see Thibs, though, and they still have KG. I don't know, like, he sat out like the whole second half of the year. I don't know how much they're hoping to get from him next year. And they have Gorgui Dieng as well, both guys who I think are more fives, but played at the four and were reasonably effective last year. I mean, I could see Thibs just wanting to go for another traditional four. That's the way he really wanted to play in Chicago nearly exclusively.
Yeah, to go back to Hill, the reason I like him so much is he's 25 and he's going to be an unrestricted free agent because, as you guys have talked about on the podcast at length, the Pacers declined his fourth-year option, and that makes it pretty much functionally...
Yeah, that might be like whether that or Varejao playing is like that our number one just like head desk topic on the show is difficult to say.
I was going to say it was the horse that you'd beaten most to death over the course of the
year.
But anyways, the Pacers functionally are going to have a very difficult time re-signing him, so I like the fact that, you know, you're just competing with other teams for him, and yet he's not an older player in the way that most unrestricted free agents you're going to get are.
What would you pay for him, and how many years?
I don't know if I would go more than I think the most I would go is like 3 years, $25 million for him.
Yeah, I think that's probably a lot more than a lot of people would think. You know, if you could get him for 2 years at that, or maybe even get like, you know, a non-guaranteed second year and pay him even more in the first year, that would be ideal. That's what everyone's going to be trying to do, obviously. But, you know, I think that's pretty reasonable for him, right? I mean, if you think of him as an okay seventh man, which he was in the playoffs this year for the Pacers, he's certainly above average defensively with his ability to switch, if not necessarily being a lockdown guy at any one position. And then if his shot comes around, he's really good. And he can even handle the ball a little bit.
To me, the ideal would be to get that third year partially guaranteed or a team option, because that way you give yourself full bird rights if you want to re-sign him at the end of that when he'd be 28.
Yeah, that's pretty solid. And, you know, I guess it all depends, too, on what your priorities are. I think another guy that we should probably talk about as if we're discussing their big situation, because they have some other needs too. I mean, they that we can get to, but what do you do with Deng? I think he's better at center. I don't know if, do you agree with that or no?
I mean, the combo with him and Towns was actually pretty effective last season. So I'm a little more agnostic on that, I would say.
All right. So, I mean, if you want to be a perennial 55 win team, do you think that he and Towns playing together as your starting front court for the next 4 years is the optimal way to go?
Oh, absolutely not. No.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the issue to me, is that you have to re-sign him. He's going to be extension eligible this year, restricted free agency next year. And do you want to now, I mean, he's going to get an 8-figure contract. He could actually, I think, be like a semi-decent starting center for a team, especially if he gets into like a good defensive system and gets a little better coaching, which he probably will this year from Thibs. So just putting that level of resources into a guy who's probably, you know, just a little bit of like a square peg in their round power forward hole here for Minnesota.
I guess what I'd wonder is, could you use him as part of a three-player front court where you've got more of a stretch or more of a smaller option, and then you've got Towns, obviously, as the anchor of that, and those two guys essentially trade off playing against the opposite Towns based on matchups, and then you also give Jang all of the backup minutes behind Towns. You know, maybe that way you get him to 25 to 28 minutes a night, which I think probably all you really want him playing on a good team, and that would be reasonable, I think, for an eight-figure contract. But yeah, that's maybe one reason to hold off on an extension with him, even though his value might go up, just because you're going to know more about what this team looks like and what it looks like specifically under Tibbs by the end of the season.
Yeah, and they also have the number five pick as well, and you think they have, you know, basically this entire team is on a rookie contract at this point. So you might say, and especially because coaches and especially Tibbs with his reputation kind of have this idea of wanting to win now more, what are some trades that they might realistically make for the number five pick?
I know. I mean, it's tough. I looked at this the other day with Chad Ford for the third pick and couldn't find a lot. Now, obviously, there's not quite as much value for the fifth pick, and that might fit better into, you know, some of the mid-tier veterans who are out there. But there's no obvious player that comes to mind as far as a trade. Is there someone for you?
Not really. I mean, it might be instructive to kind of think about some of the trades that have been made for picks around that level. The Sonics traded the fifth pick for the Celtics traded the fifth pick for Ray Allen, who also I think was coming to the end of his contract at that point. Am I right about that in 2007?
He still had a couple of years left, but he was already in his 30s. So
yeah, and he was also coming off of ankle surgery, and perhaps more importantly, that draft was one that didn't turn out this way necessarily, but people were talking about with some generational draft. They ended up getting Jeff Green, who is not in fact a generational player. And then
he's a generational something.
And then Ricky Rubio, the number five pick in 2009, was traded for Randy Foy and Mike Miller, who are a lot better back then and considered a lot better back then we kind of think of them now. But that obviously didn't turn out to be a great trade either. Trading for those veterans, I don't see that there's a Ray Allen type that's available at this point in time. So, I'm not sure who you would go to unless you're just going to say, hey, we'll be all right just getting like a solid starter. And then also the fact just that contracts are shorter too. Like maybe like Danilo Gallinari might be someone I would look at, but he has health concerns and he could be a free agent unrestricted at the end of next year. I think Gallo would be an awesome fit for them on offense and could play some stretch four and then, you know, play with Dang and play with Towns too in sort of the way you were talking about. But, I wouldn't want to trade it for a player any worse caliber than that.
And it seems to me that a lot of the younger guys who are potentially on the trade market, you know, I threw out in that piece that, you know, maybe Denver is willing to move Jusuf Nurkić if they view Nikola Jokic as the answer at center, or obviously Philadelphia with Noel and Jahlil Okafor. But those guys don't really solve needs for Minnesota. They should be looking at Towns as a center and not looking to add more centers.
By the way, this is a digression, but I got to push back with you on this one, that you saying that Jusuf Nurkić would be a fair return for the number three pick. I guess you're higher on Jusuf than I am.
His numbers actually ended up fairly decent last year. So I have him projected with about $22 million of net value remaining on his rookie contract, which is the typical return for the number three pick. And, you know, especially when you look at a draft where I think it's considered a weak draft after the top two, although I would disagree and would take Dragan Bender there and think he would be great if Minnesota could get him at the fifth pick. That would be amazing, in my opinion.
Yeah.
He
actually would fit in really well, I think, with what they're trying to do with his shooting. They got plenty of scoring, so like that's really kind of his ability to score is probably his big weakness at this point. So, but he could shoot threes, be a nice defensive player, could switch, plays hard, good passer, which they need more of as well. So yeah, I think that actually would be pretty sweet for them, and they have the luxury with plenty of rotation guys of letting him develop a little bit. But yeah, that would be a pretty good one. I haven't at the fifth pick. I think he has pretty good upside there, and they may need a second star still. I'm not sure that Wiggins is like quite going to be good enough to be like second banana on a really, really good championship contending team.
Yeah, I think the jury is still largely out on that. I'm probably more optimistic now than many Timberwolves fans, which is odd given that I was the Wiggins doubter, I think, when he came into the league. But
well, me too, but yeah.
Yeah, that's true. We were both on that island.
Yeah, and it's funny, like, I'm not really sure whether we were right or not yet. You know, I guess he's been above the fifth best player in the draft, which is what I had him at that point. But we'll see what happens. I think, and Tibbs obviously is the ideal coach for getting as much as they can out of him defensively. Yeah, but I mean, I think given the fact that I don't know that they have a second star yet, and I think they should probably keep the number five pick unless there's just someone who's unexpectedly available, and I haven't seen that there's, you know, a Ray Allen at age 31 level player that's out there for them. Let's see, what else did I want to ask you about? Of the old guys, is there anyone that you think would be particularly good for them to go after with a kind of a short-term overpay?
I mean, Williams and Deng both make sense from that standpoint. A reunion between Deng and Tibbs seems completely logical to me. And, you know, especially now that he's shown that he can hold up at power forward for extended stretches, he does fit what they need right now.
I also wouldn't mind them just grabbing a traditional, too, a Courtney Lee, even an Eric Gordon kind of rehab project guy who can shoot the three, at least in the case of Lee, play some pretty good defense. Alan Crabb is also someone I might consider for them. And then either he or Levine could come off the bench because they don't really have much shooting, especially off the bench for this team. So that would be another way that I would look. Anyone else that you like for them at number five, since you're probably actually more up in the draft than I am? I'm like only three players deep in my film review at this point.
I mean, Buddy Hield could sort of fill that role that we're talking about with Crabb. I think he's actually a little underrated defensively at this point because he's shown some good ability to lock and trail away from the ball. And people keep referring to him as undersized, but, you know, he's like 40th percentile of size for a shooting guard.
What shooting guards are you like? Is he going to struggle to? I mean, like, maybe like Klay Thompson or something, like, you know, just in terms of contesting a high release. But they're not like, this isn't like 1997 when there are like post up shooting guards left and right.
Yeah. So Hield, I don't think he has the ceiling that someone like Bender does for them if he's still out there, but fills a clear need for them and would help them right away, I think.
Yeah, I know your stats aren't as high on Jamal Murray, but I think, although I haven't watched a ton of film of him yet, I think he is going to be an awesome shooter no matter what. I'd be surprised if he's not at least a good offensive player, and you could maybe even play him at the one or the two, get some shooting. The ability to shoot going behind a pick and roll screen is something that I love, as that's like, to me, the biggest thing I'm looking for these days in my point guards, because it's just that is something that teams can't really deal with that well. So if he falls to them, I think that would be another great way for them to go.
No, Murray's actually third in my consensus or fourth, I guess, in my consensus projections.
He scores well in like the subjective and not as well in the objective component, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's not great, but the feature of this year's draft is that after the Bender, Ingram, Simmons group, there's basically no one on whom the stats and the scouts are in complete agreement.
Yeah, that makes sense, and maybe that's part of why it's viewed as not that great of a draft.
Yep.
All right, what about backup point guard? I mean, they basically have Tyus Jones. I think Jones can be pretty good, but hasn't really proven it yet. You know, he's only 21 or whatever he is, so I think he should be given a chance, but you also probably need to have some sort of a stopgap in case he's not ready if you're really trying to be, you know, a team that's going to be in contention for the playoffs.
Yeah, I think it's similar to like you discussed with John Hamm with Cameron Payne in Oklahoma City. Obviously, you know, more of a concern there because the Thunder are a championship contender in a different tier than Minnesota, but similar case where you'd like to ideally have someone who can play those minutes if need be, but also is willing to take a third guard role if Jones does prove ready. So, you know, Brian Roberts might be someone that might fit that.
Yeah, I like him a lot there too. And then also a guy who can play off the ball for you a little bit with his shooting. Even Mo Williams might be another guy if he decides to opt out in Cleveland. We'll see. He's probably, although he's had knee trouble all year. Mario Chalmers as a potential reclamation project. DJ Augustin. I think those kind of guys. I want someone who can shoot the ball on this team as well. And maybe someone that you could even give some Rubio minutes to if in a particular game they just can't deal with the fact that, you know, Rubio can't shoot that well. Although I think that's always kind of been a little bit of an overrated factor.
Yep.
Is there anyone that you could see them going after that, like, you'd kind of be scared of?
Well, I think Joakim Noah is the obvious guy here.
Oh, God. Yeah. I think Joe actually can be pretty good, but, like, really, they need another center. They already have three centers and really, like, no proven power forwards on this team. Like, so, and just, yeah, Towns could play power forward, you know, with his shooting, but then his post-up game is going to be neutered because the spacing will be taken away, especially with Noah, who just can't hit a shot outside of 2 feet anymore, and actually probably can't hit a shot inside of 2 feet either. So it's, I think that would just be a totally miserable signing, and I could even see them overpaying a fair amount for that, too, because Noah probably wants to go somewhere that's a little bit more of an established contender, and then he even has health problems, too.
Yeah, one thing I did hear, though, is that several Chicago players are interested in playing for Tibbs again. So don't let any of the talk about, you know, his brutal practices and what a taskmaster he is fool you on that one.
I think another one who I would be a little worried about is Ryan Anderson. He's someone who could really juice their offense right away, but and could play with either Dang or, but you know, paying him $20 million a year. Though that's a good question for you, actually. Like, who is? We've been hearing Ryan Anderson's going to make $20 million a year. Who is actually going to pay him that?
I guess Sacramento.
Well, they have to. Then they'll have nobody at point guard unless they're just going to roll with Darren Collison.
Yeah, which they might
because they have to use. Yeah, they got to use cap space on Rondo, so or whoever else they would want to bring in at point guard. And they go on to find minutes for Cauley Stein, too, and Rudy Gay and Omri Caspi. Yeah, I'm not sure who that is. Maybe the Rockets, if they strike out on everybody, they could use a stretch four option.
But I don't think they're going to pay him $20 million. If they're going to get Ryan Anderson, it's going to be because he's at, you know, maybe 12 to 15. So maybe he's an example of what Mark Cuban talked about the other day where, you know, there's this assumption that everyone's going to get all this salary as a free agent, and some guys aren't. They're just not going to have that market.
Yeah, and I think also just that he is a guy who is just much more effective 5 years ago than he is now. Not even just due to his decline in skills, which has occurred, but also just because teams are playing smaller. There are more combo forwards now. You're not just fewer teams are like going to leave a traditional power forward, and even those guys are better, more experienced at guarding someone like Anderson at this point, because every team, it seems like, has shooting at the four now.
I tend to think you overrate that a little bit, but it's weird. He's like 28, but I would think of him as like one of those guys in their 30s because just the mileage he has with his back issues and everything like that, he functionally is older than he really is.
Another guy, so we're getting to now looking at 2017, because that is sort of the opportunity cost for this team with anyone that they sign beyond 1 year, and then they've got extension negotiations for Dang and Muhammad. What would you be comfortable with offering someone like Muhammad, or maybe Muhammad himself? Someone like that's always like one of the dumbest verbal crutches, right? It's someone like this guy, but when you're actually just talking about him.
I definitely wouldn't offer any more than like 3 years, $15 million, and I can't see him taking that.
We couldn't give him like the Jeremy Lamb contract?
I don't know. Was the Jeremy Lamb contract a good contract?
You know, if you look at some of his advanced stats this year, maybe. If you ask Steve Clifford about his level of commitment during the playoffs, maybe not.
Right.
But, you know, it's also, I think, kind of a decent risk. You know, I mean, when that's basically like a $4 million contract used to be. So you're kind of just like, hey, this guy's got some talent. We could lock him up. If it doesn't work out, fine. But we're just sort of like playing the lottery here that if he works out, maybe he's a value contract as like a high scoring sixth man type.
I just don't want Shabazz Muhammad on my team. And I get the feeling that Tom Thibodeau is probably going to feel similarly.
What about Dang?
So that's an interesting one. I think, you know, like I said, you want to be conservative with him in terms of extension talks. You've always got the leverage of the fact that he's got a really low cap hold for the next summer. Is a guy who was taken, I think, what, 24th late in the draft, suffice it to say. So I probably wouldn't offer him more than about like 4 years, $48 million. Actually, maybe you don't even want to go that many years because he is older than he.
He's going to be 27 by the time he actually reaches restricted free agency.
Yeah, so it might be more like 3 years, $36 million on an extension offer, and just kind of see what happens next season. Understand he's probably not going to take that.
Yeah, his cap hold is just under $6 million. So, you know, if you do sign him to something like that, you're only punting on $6 million in cap space basically for 2017-18. That's not that bad to get him locked up. I mean, I think if he just plays the same way next year that he played this year, someone would give him $15 million a year to be their starting center probably, and you'd then have to decide whether you wanted to match that or not. So we talked about the opportunity costs that they could have up to 40 million in space next summer, but who is really available for them in 2017 that, let's say they have this good season that we're talking about, they fight for the eighth seed, maybe even make the playoffs, is there anyone that really is like, all right, we got to keep the powder dry for 2017, we cannot sign someone this year that could realistically come here?
I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting question. Like, the idea of someone like a Durant or a Westbrook, or, you know, older players like Chris Paul, who probably makes a little less sense from the Timberwolves from a timeline standpoint. The idea of them going to Minnesota, like, that's one of those things that, like, smart people will probably write about next year, and then it will have no chance of actually happening.
Yeah, I think that you know, Paul or Westbrook are the guys that, you know, you talk about. Curry, you assume, is going to stay put. You know, I don't think that either of those guys, I mean, Westbrook running a pick and roll with Towns would be unbelievable, but... And, you know, maybe these guys will just look so good that it's like people are going to want to get on board. I mean, although I think Rubio is maligned and is a good player, that if you really want to get into championship contention, he's just, his lack of shooting at point guard is going to be too much of an impediment as you really get deep into a playoff series. So they could use an upgraded point guard. Kyle Lowry would be a free agent. I think he could be a good fit. Drew Holiday, as well as guys who can shoot a little bit more, play on or off the ball around some of their stars, then maybe they could look to move Rubio, who would have 2 years left at $14 million if they could get someone like that. And then at power forward, I actually think one of the big dreams for them would be Serge Ibaka. That could just make like an unbelievable defense for this team. Or Blake Griffin, Paul Millsap, like those kind of guys at the forward. Griffin, maybe not that good of a fit, but Millsap or Ibaka, and they would have the space to just overpay those guys, you know, up to the maximum for a couple of years.
Yeah, especially if Ibaka, if what we saw from him in the conference finals is really who he is going forward. And, you know, I know there was a lot of concern about lost athleticism and maybe even some whispers in Oklahoma City that he was older than his listed age, which is only, I think, about 4 months younger than Gorgui Dieng, despite the a massive amount longer that he's been in the league. But if, you know, if he really is 27, 28 by the time he hits free agency, then, or yeah, 28 by the time that he would first play for Minnesota, then that fits, I think, with Minnesota's timeline. And his skills are awesome next to Towns.
Yeah. Also, if we have another year of Wiggins under our belt to see whether he really can be a primary option on the wing. If they don't feel that way, they could, you know, Gordon Hayward, Gallo would be available too, I think. J.J. Redick will be a free agent. He might be a nice fit in the short term. Andre Iguodala, though, you know, and with Golden State probably trying to use cap space, they actually could end up losing him potentially in 2017. So there are some really good fits out there, but we're so far away. It's so far attenuated right now. And that's, we're talking about assuming that they're just going to be good next year, which we don't even know that that's true for that matter.
Right. Yeah. Which is kind of a necessary thing for them to get into this level of the market. Otherwise, you know, I don't know what the plan B is there, but yeah, like Hayward, I love for them. I think that, you know, having another guy who can shoot and handle the ball like that to me, there's no downside to having multiple guys who can do that as long as they can also play off the ball. But again, he's probably going to be playing for a fairly up and coming team in his own right, where he's been his entire career in Utah.
Another thing to consider too is that, let's say they spend all their cap space in 2017, then the cap is flat. And you have to extend basically probably, we're going to assume for the maximum, both Andrew Wiggins and Karl Towns. So you're adding basically a salary that's at the cap. And now you're also adding on, you know, basically another $40 million in salaries over their rookie contracts for Wiggins and Towns. That definitely could be a little bit of a concern as far as the luxury tax for them. So that might be partially a reason to not stretch Pekovic at all, or someone might have to go. I don't see this team as being like a huge tax paying team, but that would be one of those good problems if, you know, they really have that good of players where they're spending up to the cap in the long term. But something to keep in mind for a few years down the road for this squad.
Right, and if they don't stretch Pekovic and keep his $11.6 million for next summer, it almost acts as a bit of a break to that because it keeps them from spending as much in free agency.
Yeah, but, you know, if this is a special team, I think Tibbs is certainly not going to have any qualms about wanting to go for it, and maybe the fact that Glenn Taylor or whoever even ends up being the new owner, if you know, Steve Kaplan or whoever else, it seems like Glenn Taylor is looking to sell at some point soon. So maybe they will have more of an appetite for the luxury tax. And when you have a potential superstar like Towns, the ability to spend while those guys are still on cheap rookie contracts shouldn't be discounted, even if they might get into the tax or have to dump someone later. I mean, we saw what happened to Oklahoma City when, with a really good young team, they kind of got afraid of the tax and made some moves that they obviously, I think, you know, with James Harden probably ended up regretting. I think you're better off just kind of signing guys when you have the chance, and then if you need to dump some contracts, you can. That seems to make a lot more sense than just not making the moves to begin with because you were afraid of the tax like 2 years from now.
Yeah, that's, you've got a long time to figure that out. To me, it's also a reason to try to make sure you don't trade many future draft picks, keep replenishing your bench with young guys on cost-controlled rookie deals, and that maybe could be a reason to make a move. You know, if you don't think you're going to end up re-signing Jang at next year's trade deadline, and you could potentially get a first-round pick for him to replace the one that they might have to send out from the ill-fated Adrian Payne deal. That I think
He's still on the team. We haven't even mentioned him yet. I guess, but he probably is going to get his rookie option declined. I bet
you
for his fourth
so.
Year.
Yeah,
since he's maybe Tibbs will want to see what he can get out of him, and they will have all a training camp to evaluate him at least. And he does have some athleticism, so maybe Tibbs can another raw project that he can kind of get to play well. They also do not have a 2018 pick from that trade. It is lottery protected. You have to imagine that that'll probably go. And then, yeah, I mean, who they get with this number five pick, we sort of haven't really been thinking about that too much, but that could be another big part of the core. And I think trading that pick when, you know, really your timeline is 3-4 years from now would be pretty short-sighted for them. A little bit of housekeeping. Greg Smith is on the roster. I would expect him to be waived. He is a guaranteed date of January 10th. And then Damian Rudez has actually a team option with a date of 6/24. Rudez has not really contributed at all in either Indiana or Minnesota. So with that team option where they have to decide, but then you have to imagine that that would be declined as well.
Yep.
Anything else you wanted to say about these guys before we go?
I don't know. I mean, I guess as I go through this, my thinking about what might be an ideal plan for them is to draft, if Bender's out there, draft him at five, and then you grant that you're probably not going to get much from him in the next couple of years, so you sign one of those older combo forwards as a stopgap between now and then as their contract comes up, that's presumably right when Bender would be able to step into a larger role.
Yeah, that does sound like a pretty good plan to me as well. Yeah, I mean, just the only contract that's going to scare me for them is someone in their late 20s, early 30s, going 3 or 4 years. Like, that's really good. What I think is the one where there's going to be a pretty darn big opportunity cost, especially at the point where you haven't even seen what this team is yet under Tibbs and with some of these young guys. Like, I think you need more information on how good these guys are before you make that sort of win now move.
Yeah, 100% agree.
Anything to plug before we go?
We've been counting down, as you tweeted about earlier, we're kind enough to mention, the top 25 NBA Finals games since 1980 on ESPN. Some free content for you guys. I went through and subjectively ranked them all, and it was a lot of fun to work on.
I can't believe you put that that 2010 Game 7 as higher than like those other two that I talked about. The 2011 Game 2, which I thought was like the seminal game of that series, basically, like that denied the Heat that championship. That was just such an ugly game, and Kobe shooting 6 out of 24. I get it was a Game 7 and Lakers-Celtics, but I mean, my eyes were watering watching that one. It was so ugly.
I mean, that's why it was so low in the rankings. That's, you know, on paper, a Game 7 that was, I think, a three-point game with a minute left before Ron Artest hit the three-pointer to push it to 6. That sounds like it should be an amazing game, and it just wasn't.
Well, the Celtics didn't have their full team. Like that doesn't even count, really. Like, without Kendrick Perkins, like, you shouldn't even count that game.
Yeah, we'll have to release a Boston version that does not include that. We can put one of the Celtics wins from like over the Rockets in like 86 in there instead of it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of like what my theory will be on the greatest finals game. You don't have to tell me, but I'm just making this prediction on record that it's going to be Game 6, 1998 will probably be the one, and then maybe, or no, actually I'm going to say Game 6, 2013, and then Game 6, 1998 will probably be second. That is my guess. You can keep your poker face on that one for now. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Kevin is K Pelton. You can get all of his awesome content. When are you going to come out with the final draft rankings with the international guys?
Looking at probably next week for that, I think.
Awesome. That'll be good. And of course, Kevin will be back as well for our mock off season, which is a little more than 2 weeks away. So thanks so much for coming on, Kevin. Leave us an iTunes review or rating. That really helps us out a lot. Keeps us up there in those rankings. That's part of the algorithm. And also, there was some guy who gave us 1 star because we're so biased for the Warriors today. So we got to drown out that review, obviously. Or maybe everyone who thinks that we are biased towards the Warriors will now provide another like 100 1 star reviews seconding that guy. But in any event, thanks for listening. Don't forget too about athletescollective.com with that cap space code, our sponsor for today, to get yourself some great high quality but somewhat less expensive activewear that my girlfriend says looks good on me, and I'm sure your girlfriend will say it looks good on you as well. We'll talk to you. We're not going to actually record tomorrow since there's no game. We'll be back on Friday night for a pivotal game 4 of the NBA Finals. Talk to you all then.